Pansifer's Podcast, a podcast on Rosicrucianism, Hermeticism, and the teachings of the Western esoteric tradition, where adepts, practitioners, researchers share their views.
Hello, friends and listeners, and welcome to this episode 2 of the Pansifer's Podcast. Almost, I said, the Thos Hermes Podcast. I'm so used to that. Of course, this is the Pansifer's Podcast, the new brand of myself, of Rudolf, your host. And of course, the Thos Hermes Podcast still exists. I think you figured it out in the meantime. And today I'm going to welcome on this show my guest, Christopher McIntosh, and we are going to talk about mainly his latest book. He wrote over 20, he's going to tell you all about it in the interview. He wrote a book lately about occult Germany, and 2 years ago, another one on occult Russia. So two countries for different reasons that have not been so much in the focus of occult research, of book writers, etc. And it will be very interesting for us to find out why this is and why Christopher himself chose to write those two books, among many others, even a novel he has written. We're going to talk about all that. This time, we are not going to talk so much about his life, his background himself, because if you are long-time listeners of the Thos Hermes Podcast, you might have come across in April 2020, it was, I had to think a moment, in April 2020, so 4.5 years ago, oh my God, in season 4, I had Christopher on this show with an interview about himself and about Rosicrucianism back at the time, because of course, Rosicrucianism is a big topic of his as well, as it is when you talk about occult Germany, of course. So if you're interested in the background on Christopher himself, do, after the show, go back to season 4 of the Thos Hermes Podcast and listen to that. Today, here, as I said, it'll be Germany, a bit of Russia in the second part, and all their occult works and backgrounds, and what Christopher has found about them. So, and as, of course, I am also from that part of the world, and as the Pansifer's itself are a bit originated in this part of the world, Central Europe, not only Germany, but the German-speaking countries and adjacent countries, I decided for my musical choice here today to also present you German music. Very different, 3 very different types of German music. And the first piece we're going to hear is actually a piece by Clara Schumann, so a romantic classical music piece, which in fact was originally a lied, so a song, a German song, by the title Ich stand in dunklen Träumen. I was standing in dark dreams. Also, by the title itself, you can see it's very, very German romanticism. Clara Schumann, for those of you who don't know, an important figure, especially for one of the first female composers that made her way. Of course, she was in the shadow of her very famous brother, Robert Schumann, the famous romantic composer. And so she also was a composer back, even back at the time. She was not recognized, of course, in the same way as a male composer would be. And more over the last decennies, I would say, she has come to the foreground, and for good reasons, because it's wonderful music that she wrote. And this is not the original work, but we hear a version of her song played by piano, cello, and oboe. Actually, those two, cello and oboe, are really my favorite classical instruments. So maybe that's also why I chose that version, but it's really beautiful. I think you're going to enjoy it. So I talked a lot about music, but you know, music's my thing. So I always want to put good music and explain also a bit about it in the show. And as I said, the other two pieces of music, the one in the break of the show, of the interview, and at the end of the interview are very different. I'm going to say a little bit about that later on. And for now, let's listen to Clara Schumann and Ich stand in dunklen Träumen. And after that, we go right away into the interview with Christopher McIntosh. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Here comes the interview.
Well, those of you who were carefully listening to the last episode here on the Pantsovers podcast, when I spoke with Tobias Churton, then you heard that Toby was mentioning somebody, a good friend of his, Christopher McIntosh. And it's not a coincidence, because of course, who else should we speak to if we want to really get in-depth knowledge and information and also experience of occultism in Germany, also related to Rosicrucianism, but not exclusively, of course. Who else should we speak to then? To Christopher McIntosh. And Christopher, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show here today. Thanks for being with us on Pantsovers podcast.
Well, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, you were on South Hermes with me about 2 or 3 years ago, and we were then discussing mainly the Rosicrucian approach that you took with a book, then The History of the Rosicrucians. And we were talking also about yourself as a person and what brought you to the subject and what was important to you in it. Today, we are trying to focus mainly on your latest book, which is Occult Germany. And when we prepared for this interview, you told me that maybe I'm not going to speak long about your life and about your background, because those who are interested, they should go to that interview I just mentioned on South Hermes about that. But when we speak today about occult Germany, I think we cannot completely set you and your personal life and your experience in your personal life aside. So tell me why. Tell me in what respect those two things, Germany and Christopher McIntosh and the occult, are related.
Well, my relationship with Germany goes back a long way. In fact, to my early childhood, when I was growing up in Edinburgh, back in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And we had a young German woman staying with us for a time, who was studying at Edinburgh University. And she was called Ingrid. And she was a lovely woman, and I absolutely adored her. And she taught me my first words of German. So that she was really was my first contact with a German person. And I liked her so much that it would have been surprising that if I hadn't really fallen in love with her country. So then I kept up with her for a number of years. And then lost contact with her for about 20 years, I think. Then one day I was traveling in Germany on a train from Vienna back to England. And there was a rail strike with the result that when the train got to about Bonn, I heard that it wasn't going to go much further. And I remembered that Ingrid lived near Bonn, so I gave her a call and said, could I come and stay with her for a couple of nights? And she said, yes, of course. She came and picked me up at the station at Bonn. And I spent a very pleasant couple of days with her in her house in the Rhineland, mm-hmm. near Königswinter. And so that was, meanwhile, I had started learning German at school at the age of 13. And I later on, I took a degree in German as a mature student at London University. Meanwhile, I had started getting interested in esoteric things. Mm-hmm. And I found, much to my delight, that Germany is really the fountainhead of esoteric traditions. When you think of something like the alchemical tradition, which was so strong in Germany, and in fact remains so today. I found it a great advantage to know German when I started really studying esoteric traditions like Rosicrucianism.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really study the Rosicrucian tradition without knowing German.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, and I was able to read old German handwriting, which was also a great advantage. So that I was able to read original manuscripts in German. And later on, I did a PhD thesis on the Rosicrucian revival of the 18th century. And again, it was a great advantage doing that thesis that I was able to read German, read the old German manuscripts. But it wasn't just a scholarly interest. Let me put it this way: I'm a romantic by temperament, and the Germans are a very romantic people.
Mm.
When I speak of Germany, I'm talking about the whole linguistic and cultural realm, including Germany, Austria, German-speaking Switzerland, and outlying territories. So this was another thing that attracted me to Germany.
Mm.
The essence of Romanticism, well, it involves, an attraction to things that are nebulous and mysterious and half-hidden.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of that famous painting by Caspar David Friedrich of a man on a mountaintop looking out over a sea of mist.
Right.
Well, that's very German. And it also involves a longing for that which is far away in time or in space or somehow difficult to attain. And, for example, German sea shanties are full of longing for faraway places or being in faraway places and longing for the homeland.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's even a longing for longing itself. I don't know if you know that song by Marlene Dietrich where she sings that if she were granted a wish, she wouldn't know whether to wish for happiness or sadness, because if she were too happy, she would have a yearning for sadness again.
Do you remember the title of that song in German?
No, but I remember how it begins. It's, wenn ich mir was wünschen dürfte, käme ich in Verlegenheit.
Okay.
If you enter those words on Google, I think you'll get it straight away.
I'm sure we're going to play this in the interlude in the break of our talk, you know, that's
why. That would be great. Yes. Yeah. Well, so this is something very German, this longing for longing itself, and somehow it's something that appeals to me. That's part of my temperament.
Right.
So that was another thing that attracted me to Germany. Well, then I moved here for career reasons 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed on and I married a German woman. So here I am. And then I thought, well, it was time that I wrote a book about occult Germany, as I've been so preoccupied with it for such a long time with occult and esoteric things. And Germany is such a center of these studies that, and as I'm living here, I thought it was the obvious thing to do, to write this book on occult Germany.
Well, of course, when one speaks the language, when one has the knowledge and the experience, also the local experience, the feeling of a country, it's yes. Something that, of course, much closer. But I would like maybe a bit later we go into another book that you published 2 years earlier, Occult Russia.
Yes.
We go into that a bit later. But having said that, both countries, but maybe even more so in Germany or the German-speaking countries, as you just said. I don't know what your experience is. I live, as you know, close to Austria, the capital Vienna. So yeah. We are in kind of in the same cultural circuits. And it was for a long time for me very difficult when I was and got interested in the work of esotericism and occult to find like-minded people here, because it was in a much different way than it seems to be in France or in the UK or in North America, and hidden away for probably very particular reasons, a bit like in Italy as well, right?
Yeah,
So is that also your experience, or, and if so, can you maybe give us, before we go into some more detail on your book, an analysis why this would be the case?
Yes, well, in my book, I speak about what I call the elephant in the room,
mm-hmm.
which is the Nazi period.
Right.
And this elephant in the room is like a kind of presence that either it dominates the debate, or else is studiously avoided, in which case it dominates the debate anyway. And even when the elephant is invisible, it would, people are talking about something else entirely, like art history or whatever. This elephant is always there, and so people sort of skirt around it very carefully to avoid touching it.
Right.
So, as a result of this elephant, the way that it's been associated with the irrational, there's been, since the war, there's been a great reaction against anything that's held to be irrational.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is, this doesn't apply to, so much to the general public. It applies more to the intellectual and cultural establishments.
Right.
So, like, for example, the people who were involved in the Frankfurt School, like the philosopher Theodor Adorno.
Adorno, yes.
Yeah. Mm. And he is recorded as having said that esotericism is the metaphysics of dances, of blockheads, Dunkelköpfe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I find that terribly sad, because in saying that, he's rejecting the whole rich mystical and esoteric history of Germany, you know, going back right back to figures like Hildegard of Bingen, the great mystic and physician and visionary of the Middle Ages, and people like Meister Eckhart and Jakob Boehme, the great mystic of the 15th and 16th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And not to mention the esoteric elements in Goethe's work. And the whole alchemical tradition, which is absolutely central to German cultural history, and how English, for example, a German, Albert Riedel, who took alchemy to the States and founded the thing called Paracelsus College. And so it's thanks to these German alchemists that alchemy is still alive today. Oh, and a figure like, more recently, a figure like Rudolf Steiner.
Of course.
In my opinion, Steiner is one of the really great German figures, because he, in my view, almost better than anyone else, embodied that Rosicrucian tradition of combining the spiritual and the material.
Yeah.
He was a very mystical, spiritual person, but at the same time, he was very practical.
Mm-hmm.
It's biodynamic agriculture and sort of homeopathic medicine
and schooling. Yes.
The schooling, yes, and all, yes. all that. Yes. So mm-hmm. that again is that's part of something that's also very German.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, all of these things. So I find this rejection of the whole mystical and esoteric heritage by certain people. I find that very sad and a great pity.
Definitely.
And it's led to a certain sort of loss of cultural memory. I noticed this when I was teaching English at the University of Bremen. And in one class, we got onto the subject of the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. And I said to the students, well, do you know what that was? And only one young guy raised his hand and he said, I think it's got something to do with rejuvenation or eternal life or something like that. And in other words, he didn't really have a clue. Mm. And the others, I don't think had even heard of the Holy Grail.
May I ask when, about, in what year, about, approximately, that was?
This was about, it would have been about 2004 or 2005, okay. Around that mm-hmm. time, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Now, to me, the Holy Grail is one of those universal references that everybody should know about. You know, I grew up with the stories of King Arthur and the likes of the Round Table and the quest for the Holy Grail and Parsifal and Galahad and all of that.
Yeah.
And it's also part of German cultural history when you think of Wagner's operas, like Parsifal and but even part of modern American culture when you think of films like Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yes.
Well, the English film, but so I thought that was extraordinary that they'd never heard of the Holy Grail. And I meet Germans who'd never heard of the Eckensteiner, for example. It's like an English person saying they'd never heard of Stonehenge.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of gap in the cultural knowledge. But I think that is changing a little bit as time goes by.
I have two questions for you regarding that. They are not exactly related. Maybe let me put the thing with the Holy Grail first. I think the Holy Grail, to me, but please correct me if you see it differently, is a perfect example of a very pan-European culture in a way, because you just mentioned yourself, we have, of course, origins of the Holy Grail story in France, in the south of France. We have some part of it in England, where we see Arthurian legends. Then we have the German part of the Graz legend, and not only with Wagner, but much before. Of course, I'm talking about Middle Ages here. Yes, exactly. So it is kind of a European idea, which is, of course, much earlier than what we have nowadays called the European Union. But at the time, it was a cultural effect that was there. It didn't have to be invented. And Germany was full part of that. And
yes.
I got a bit the impression that regrouping of cultural ideas fell apart also maybe through the wars, not only the Second, but the First World War, etc. And we are still trying to recollect those broken parts and glue them together again. Or is that, do you see that differently?
No, I would agree with that, yes. Yeah.
Even the Rosicrucian idea, in a way, is something somehow related to that as well.
Yes.
And the other question I had, I get the impression that this elephant in the room that you mentioned is also often used exactly the other way around. I'm not talking by extremists or so. I'm just talking when somebody tries to write a book, a serious book on occultism in Germany, they write about Norse tradition, they write about the runes, and make a statement that this is the German tradition, which is of course, part of it, but yeah. It's not at all the German tradition. And by doing that, they put too much weight on something which might have been partly abused also by some extremists, right? So yeah, yeah. Why is this happening? Why are we taking just that window into the German tradition instead of seeing how wide and broad it actually is?
Mm, yes. Well, it's a tendency to throw the baby out with the bathwater. One of the things that I hope this book will do is make people aware of this immensely rich German tradition,
yes.
This spiritual and mystical and esoteric tradition, and stop focusing too much on the kinds of things that they associate with the Third Reich and the Nazi movement.
Yes,
which is why I didn't write too much about that in the book.
Yeah, so much has been written about that already.
Right? Yes, exactly. Yes,
And I mean, it's kind of a slim book. It's about 220, 240 pages. It is very concise and very, very interesting. And you start, and I find that very interesting. And the first chapter is named Heidelberg, an Enchanted Gateway, right?
Yes.
Tell us why did you take the door through Heidelberg?
Well, I felt that Heidelberg was a good entry point, because Heidelberg is a sort of microcosm of much of what I write about in the book. Because you've got Heidelberg Castle, which was the castle of the elect of Frederick V of the Palatinate. And for a time, Heidelberg was almost a kind of Rosicrucian court. Frances Yates writes about this in her book, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And he had that wonderful garden built by the French garden architect Salomon de Caus. And that garden was really encapsulated the Rosicrucian spirit. Because, again, it was that sort of combination of the spiritual and the material. There were statues that played tunes and automata and a wonderful series of terraces and parterres, all on that wonderful hillside overlooking Heidelberg and the River Neckar. So that was one reason for starting with Heidelberg. But then there's, in Heidelberg, there's a Mithraeum, which I also mentioned, because the Mithras cult goes back to Roman times. And
I didn't know that. When was that built, the Mithraeum in Heidelberg, approximately?
Well, what you see there now is a reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Mithraeum there. It's incorporated into the museum.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that's also interesting, because Freemasonry is thought to be related to, in some way, there's a link between the history of Freemasonry and the Mithras cult.
Yeah.
And then there's if you go across the river. Well, yeah, if you go across the river, the other side of the Neckar, there's the house where Max Weber lives. Max Weber, the great pioneer of sociology. And Max Weber, he's known for his friend's remark about the disenchantment of the world,
mm-hmm.
Which is usually interpreted as welcoming this disenchantment in favor of rationalism and science and so on. But in fact, I think he was lamenting the disenchantment as the price that we pay for rationalism. And Max Weber was a member of a circle there in Heidelberg, involving all kinds of people who were exploring mystical and esoteric traditions. For example, he came into contact with Rudolf Steiner, and he was also involved in the Monte Verita project.
In Ascona, I believe that is, right?
Yeah, Ascona in Switzerland, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a kind of proto-hippie colony, where they used to dance around naked in the grounds and go in for very kind of free sexual life and so on. And he went there, Max Weber went there. So he's another interesting Heidelberg figure. And then a little bit further, just outside Heidelberg, was a former monastery lived in by Alexander von Bernus. He was a very interesting figure because he was a poet and an alchemist. And he had an alchemical laboratory at this former monastery. So I think it was called Stift Neubau.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he founded the firm of Soluna, which was producing chemical remedies according to the method of Paracelsus.
Okay.
And that firm is still going. It's under a different ownership now, but it's still going. They're still producing their alchemical remedies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then up on the hill, further up beyond the town, is a huge amphitheater that was built by the Nazis. To hold some solar rituals, and that's all free.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things, were centered on Heidelberg. So that was the reason why I started a book with the Heidelberg chapter.
It seems like when I hear you saying all those examples, like if Heidelberg were a kind of a focal point of occultism, esotericism in Germany, would you see it like that, or is it
one of the coincidence
in your point of view? Or
I think it's one of the focal points. One of the focal points.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Sure. Mm. Not the only one, for sure.
Only one.
Mm. Yeah. But you just mentioned Eckstein Castle before, right? That people don't know anymore about it. But I think we should would make a remedy to that. Maybe you can tell us now here a bit what that is, because even inside Germany, people don't know, as you said, but outside Germany, and we have most of our listeners outside Germany.
Right.
Maybe you could give a bit of an explanation of that location.
Well, the Eckstein-Steiner is a very remarkable rock formation. It's near Paderborn.
Yeah.
When you go there, you drive through fairly sort of flat countryside, and suddenly you come upon this extraordinary rock formation rising up out of the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a holy site in prehistoric times. And later on, it was co-opted by the Christians. There are all sorts of interesting carvings on the rock face of one of the cliffs. One of them is a depiction of what is thought to be the Irminsul, which was the sacred pillar of the Saxons. And it's a rather curious and unmistakable shape, because it's sort of like a candlestick with two branches coming out from it and curling around.
Mm-hmm.
This Irminsul is shown apparently bowing down before the Christian cross. And this has been taken by modern pagans as a representation of the Irminsul, and it's often reproduced in that form. So that's one feature of the Eckensteiner, and there's also a chapel. If you go up a stairway up to the top of one of the cliffs, and there's a chapel which has been carved out of the solid rock, and it's not quite clear whether this is a Christian chapel or a very much older one.
Mm-hmm.
It has very curious features which don't seem to fit with a Christian chapel. But anyway, so that's the Eckensteiner. And it was, during the Nazi period, it was very much, there was a lot of interest in it because it was a link with the pre-Christian pagan worship.
Yeah. Which they cherished, of course, a lot because of ideological reasons.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Mm. Well, then, in recent years, it's become, well, it was for a long time, a favorite meeting place for sort of neo-pagans and hippies and revelers who would go there at the summer solstice and hold this huge celebration there with the house. I went there once with my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good fun, but it's unfortunately banned now. I think probably because they left such a mesh behind them.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so that's the Eckensteiner.
And if you compare that to Stonehenge, for example, because you mentioned that in combination just before,
yeah.
Is it comparable or is it very different? I mean, Stonehenge, the stones have been erected, right? And
yes.
Eckensteiner is, of course, a natural phenomenon. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But apart from that, is it comparable?
Well, it's as you say, it's much less well known than Stonehenge, mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's Stonehenge. Stonehenge is a great meeting point. And to some people go there in summer solstice and hold a big celebration.
Right.
And nowadays the Eckensteiner is no longer accessible for that kind of event.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned before that of course when we speak about or when you speak about Germany here in that context, it's beyond the German borders, the borders of the country, Germany, but it's a language question, more or less. But do you see differences between, well, maybe we even have, if we go historically, even have to include a region which goes as far as Prague or so, when we talk about alchemy and the development of alchemy in the German-speaking countries at the time.
Yes.
Do you see any difference between what today is Germany and those other German-speaking countries in their occult evolution, development, or is that for you really one area?
Well, if you look at the Czech Republic, for instance, the Czech Republic had a large German population, and Prague was really a dual city,
mm-hmm.
German and Czech, and that was very enriching, because if you take someone like Kafka, Kafka at one point had to decide whether he was going to write in Czech or German.
Yes.
Because his family background is German-speaking, he wrote in German.
Well, Smetana's mother tongue was German as well, for example.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Gustav Meyring.
Yes.
another famous Prague figure.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote in German.
Another Viennese Prague, and exactly another. The link Vienna Prague, of course, historically was very strong through the Habsburg Empire.
That's right. Yes, there's a lot of coming and going between the two, and there were Rosicrucian groups in both cities.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a very rich kind of interchange between the German and Czech communities. Unfortunately, that was cut off by the war, in the aftermath of the war,
mm-hmm.
when basically the German population was expelled from the Czech lands.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still, I've had a lot of contact with Prague over the years. I've been there often and I have good friends there. And I've actually been published in the Czech language. My novel, Return of the Tetra, is published in Czech. And my book on the Rosicrucians, that was also translated into Czech.
Mm-hmm.
And I can read the language a bit myself.
Okay.
Yeah. And one good friend of mine was Vladislav Zadorbilek, who published those books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he spoke very good German, and so he was an example of someone who kept up the contact with the German speaking world and German mm-hmm. language.
And especially alchemy, of course, is a very strong link also in Vienna.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, Vienna in the alchemical context was a stronghold at some point, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, right. Yes,
right.
Yes.
And
yes,
it's a pity that a lot of that got lost.
Mm. Prague is absolutely full of alchemy. And there's a wonderful alchemical museum.
Yeah.
You know that museum,
Of course, yes.
Yes,
sure.
It's a wonderful place.
It is. And I mean, they have managed in Prague to make really of this history of alchemy and all that an own touristic branch, right, in a way.
Well, yes.
Lots of people traveling there and go to see that, which other parts of Austria or Germany have completely failed to do so.
Yeah.
I want to go back to that chapter which you call Following Ancient Footprints. But before we do that, let's take a musical break and play Marlene Dietrich.
Yes, please.
Okay, good.
Man hat uns nicht gefragt, als wir noch kein Gesicht, ob wir leben wollten oder Liebe nicht. Jetzt gehe ich allein durch eine große Stadt und ich weiß nicht, ob sie mich lieb hat. Ich schaue in die Stube durch Tür und Fensterglas und ich warte auf etwas. Wenn ich mir was wünschen dürfte, käme ich in Verlegenheit. Was ich mir denn wünschen sollte, eine schlimme oder gute Zeit. Wenn ich mir was wünschen dürfte, möchte ich etwas glücklich sein. Denn wenn ich gar zu glücklich wär, hätt ich Heimweh nach dem traurig sein. Wenn ich mir was wünschen dürfte, käm ich in Verlegenheit. Was ich mir denn wünschen sollte, eine schlimme oder gute Zeit. Wenn ich mir was wünschen dürfte, möchte ich etwas glücklich sein. Denn wenn ich gar zu glücklich wär, hätt ich Heimweh nach dem Traurigsein.
Of course, as we both announced this music now before it started, announced it during the interview, I did not announce it once again for you. You got what it was. That was the famous and incredible Marlene Dietrich in that beautiful song, Wenn ich mir was wünschen dürfte, if I had a wish. And as Christopher explained a little earlier in the interview, what it was about, I will restrain from that as well. I'm talking to you anyway because we are still in that little break in the middle of the interview. I hope you're enjoying our talk. And of course, I want to announce what is coming after, what's after the interview as musical piece number 3. I told you 3 German pieces today and very different. The classic piece before, now Marlene Dietrich in the middle, and afterwards, there is a song from 1982. From those of you who are European, what the Eurovision Song Contest is, also our Australian friends in the meantime know that, this huge event on popular music competition, and each country who can send their competitor, and that happens once a year, very famous thing here in Europe. And in 1982, there was a young German woman by the name of Nicole, who sang the song Ein bisschen Frieden, a little bit of peace. And she won the contest, actually, which was a big thing then for Germany. But that song, maybe sometimes today people are smiling a bit about it because it's 1980, early 1980s. But when she had won, always the winner of the song contest is allowed to sing their winning song once again afterwards. And when she did that in 1982, also because mainly of the text, she's singing about peace, ein bisschen Frieden, a bit of peace, she sang the song to the big surprise of everyone there, in German, in English, in French, in Dutch. I think that's the 4 languages she used to show how important it is to be one community and how that little bit of peace is important. And as I'm going to point it out also towards the very end of our talk, I think that's one of the merits of Christopher by opening up our minds to subjects we are not usually talking about, maybe not enough. That's why I picked as a 3rd piece a very different German song again, Ein bisschen Frieden, by Nicole in 4 languages. And now we're going to return to Christopher McIntosh and continue talking about occult Germany and then occult Russia and other topics. So we are back here after Marlene Dietrich.
I just mentioned that chapter before we broke, which is called Following Ancient Footprints. And I find that a core chapter to your book called Germany, because also by the way you build it through the four elements that you describe, through psychedelic plants, through the woods, you know, the tree, more or less. So in what way, and it reminds me a lot of magical occult practice in Germany, right? And not only historically, also today. Where do you see the practice stand today? You live in that country. I don't know if you practice yourself, but if you want to talk about it, please do. So where do you see today in Germany the occult practice? Is it still alive? Has it been re-imported from outside, or is there still a genuine Germanic or German tradition in the country?
Oh, there is very much a native German tradition. I mentioned alchemy earlier. This is something that has never died out. And as I mentioned Alexander von Bernus and Soluna, which is still going. I think it was taken over by his wife after he died. And then it came into different hands altogether, but it's still going. They have a big place at, I think it's Donauwörth in Bavaria, where they're producing these alchemical remedies called Italy, Paracelsian method.
Well, spagyric.
Spagyric,
yes.
And there's another firm called Schulach, which is producing similar remedies, and a number of others. In every town, you will find homeopathic. You will find chemist shops selling homeopathic remedies.
And of course, Hahnemann was German too.
Hahnemann was German. Yes, exactly. So this alchemical tradition is still very much alive. And there's Rudolf Steiner, of course, the anthroposophist, who have a somewhat they're producing remedies somewhat similar to alchemical Paracelsian ones.
Yeah.
It's all in the same tradition, really.
Yeah, the Bellida firm, etc. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the Anthroposophian schools, the Waldorf schools, which are very still going strong, very well attended.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's all of that. There is kind of popular occultism, you could say. There was a man called Detlefsen, Torvald Detlefsen.
Yeah.
Well, you know about him, yeah.
Sure.
I actually translated a book by him called, in German, Schicksal als Chance, which was published as The Challenge of Fate.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a huge following.
And still has, I believe. He still has a huge following, I believe, at least in a certain generation, maybe not with very young people, but in the middle-aged generation, I think he still has quite a followership, yes.
Yes, right. Yeah. So that was a kind of, I suppose you could say, occultism made easy. Really, that was Dirk Machine. So people still following people like him.
When we speak about occultism, say in France, or let's take the English-speaking countries, because that might be easier also to compare for many people who listen here. So when you have Golden Dawn groups, or you have OTO groups, or other esoteric groups, Gardarian, Vika, whatever, right?
Yeah.
So that's very They might not be big, but there is a number of groups like that who also are actively working magic and occultism. Is there anything comparable, genuine German? I'm not saying a Golden Dawn group in Germany. That's something else, right? But out of the German tradition, not Norse tradition, but the German genuine magical tradition, is it still active in the country, or has it died out through that elephant in the room that you mentioned?
No, it's still there. Back in the early 20th century, there was a whole constellation of people following ritual magic and a kind of form, a certain form of Rosicrucianism.
Yeah.
With people like Theodor Royce.
Yes.
There was a man called Heinrich Tenker. And there was an organization called the Fraternitas Saturni that the brother of Shatin.
Which still exists, of course.
Which still exists, yes. Mm. Yes. This was a kind of, sort of mixture of Rosicrucianism, golden dawn magic, and sex magic.
Yeah.
It was all sort of mixed up together. And they were very, very active around between the wars.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, Fraternitas Saturni is still going.
Yeah, Eduard Grosche, of course, that was him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Grosche, mm-hmm. Exactly. When you say homegrown, there are various sort of homegrown worries. Like Bruyin Ra, who had a big following back between the wars, and he still has he still has a small following, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There are of course various Rosicrucian beliefs, but it's a question of whether. What you can consider homegrown, because Rosicrucianism is a German tradition. It came out of Germany. But then it was exported to other countries.
Yes.
And you had the foundation of Amok.
You have Amok group in Germany, but it didn't out of Germany. Yeah. It came out of the United States and France, of course. Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so Amok, in a way, brought Rosicrucianism back to Germany.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then there's another Rosicrucian organization called the Victorium Rosicrucianum. That's also very active in Germany.
Yes.
Mm. So it's quite a mixture. But
I think, that's my interpretation, and please let me know what you think honestly, but I think there would be room in the German-speaking countries for a revival of the, and I'm saying again, the non-Norse, nothing against the Norse tradition, I'm not saying that, but that we have heard so much about. But when I mean a revival of their homegrown tradition, I mean definitely the non-Norse tradition, but the other traditions that are there, like Meyrink had his own group at the time, I believe, right?
Yes, I think he did, yes.
Yes, and of course, Alois Mailänder, who my friend and who is also with me on Pantsofers, Sam Robinson, is writing about. Also is cool. That could be revived, couldn't it?
Yes.
Do you think it should be?
Why not? Yes.
I mean, is it worth it? Is it genuine enough to, and that it will carry itself,
Well, I think there are people involved with enough commitment.
Yes, like always, right?
There are other things going on that one wouldn't necessarily think of as obviously esoteric, but nevertheless linked to that tradition I talked about of a combination of the spiritual and the material. Like, for example, Victor Schauberger in Austria, who discovered all sorts of interesting things about properties in water. And one of his followers, Theodor Schwenk, who continued the studies of Schauberger. And so these people have made all kinds of very fascinating discoveries about water and how water is, in fact, water has a consciousness. And it has extraordinary properties. It has different forms. So some kinds of water, when you put them down a pipe, they rotate clockwise, and others rotate anti-clockwise, and these have different properties. And you know, you can energize water by passing it through a waterfall kind of arrangement. The anthroposophists invented a kind of flow form, which you call, and you can send water down, and it energizes it in a certain way. So these things are very valuable, I think, these sort of things. But you wouldn't necessarily think of them as under the category of esoteric. They're kind of, in a way, they're kind of alternative science.
Right.
But they come from the same roots.
Do you see also a hermetic, or let me put the question differently. Has the hermetic tradition also found its genuine path in Germany, or has that stayed kind of something different coming from the outside?
Well, the alchemy really belongs to the hermetic tradition.
Sure.
Yeah. And another thing I didn't mention, I've for a very long time been interested in gardens, and in particular in the history of garden, the history of the garden as a kind of as a place that conveys a symbolic message, really, or a spiritual or religious or philosophical nature. And one of my books is called Gardens of the Gods. And I was very pleased to find that in Germany, there's an enormous number of gardens of this kind.
And in Austria.
And in Austria, yes. Very, very many more than in England. The English gardening tradition is rather different. But for example, one of the places that I wrote about was the park at Wörlitz in Sachsen-Anhalt, near Dessau, and which is a really remarkable. It's laid out around a kind of extension of the river Elbe. It's around series of islands and bays and so on. And it's laid out in the form of an initiatic journey. So that, for example, as you go through it, you go into a hillside and you pass through four grottos, which are which correspond to the four elements. So you go through the grottos of the earth and water and fire, and then you come out in the grotto of air. And so the whole place is filled with this symbology, and there's a very interesting guide to the Wörlitz Park. It was built by Fritz Friedrich Franz von Sachsen-Anhalt. Yeah, and he had a kind of counselor, a kind of privy counselor called August von Rode. August von Rode advised him on the building of this park, and he wrote a guidebook in which he takes you through all of these different elements.
Oh, really?
Yes. So this is another thing, another tremendously rich heritage that Germany has in these gardens.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is the park at Luisenlund in Schleswig-Holstein.
Mm-hmm.
That's also a remarkable place. It's it was laid out by Prince von Hessen-Cassel, who was a leading Freemason. He was in every kind of rite you can imagine, very, very prominent Freemason. And again, he laid the park out as a kind of initiatory journey. Unfortunately, unlike Wurlitz, it's not been well maintained. It sort of fell into ruin.
Mm.
But there's a plan going on to restore it, which I'm involved in to some extent.
Great. That's great. Really? You just mentioned Saxony-Anhalt and also other different places in the east of Germany, former GDR. Do you think the reunification in 89 has brought about a change or maybe an enrichment in the occult traditions, a revival to a certain extent, or has the years of communism in the eastern part really deleted or killed any esoteric or occult efforts through those years?
Well, I think it. I think during the communist years, people simply didn't have access to the kind of things we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But probably, if you'd asked an East German what Freemasonry is, they wouldn't have had a clue.
Yeah.
So obviously that's changing now. But I think it'll be a slow process.
But things haven't survived in the underground. I mean, are really occult things in the underground and now resurfaced. That hasn't happened, I believe, in the former eastern provinces, right?
Well, you mean like secret Rosicrucian groups?
Yes, for example, exactly.
Room. I'm afraid I don't know. If they exist, they're probably so secret that I wouldn't do it.
Which brings us to a topic that I also wanted to bring up in this our discussion. Now moving away a little bit from Germany, and I mentioned that early in our talk. You have written another book about 2 years ago. I think it was published in 22, if I'm not wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Also with Inner Traditions, Occult Russia. And
yes,
of course, there, when speaking about communism, about the suppression of esoteric movements, Freemasonry, and all that comes with it, we have that also very present until today in Russia somehow. But also through that, maybe not in the same way as the famous elephant in the room, but also in a way, when you speak about Russia, most people, even those who are knowledgeable in occultism, don't think about that country, which is, I believe, a pity. So we mentioned your relationship to Germany and why you wrote that book. But why did you write the other book, the Occult Russia book? Extremely interesting book, which again, only people ask to get that and have a look into that. Mm. But why? What brought you to that?
Again, I have a long-standing relationship with Russia.
Okay.
Because I'm not only a Germanophile, I'm also a Russophile.
Okay.
I started learning the Russian language when I was about 19. When I spent a semester in New York at Columbia University.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned my basic Russian there, and then I sort of neglected it for a long time, until I lived for a time in America. I lived for 4 years in New York, working for the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And the United Nations has a very good language school, So I took up Russian again at the UN language school and took a diploma in Russian. And I had a very nice relationship with a Russian woman. Mm. And visited Russia a couple of times. And, then before I wrote the Russia book, I wrote another book called Beyond the North Wind, which is about the mystique of the North.
Yes, we were talking about it in our talk on Thos Hermes.
Well, during the course of writing that book, I went into the whole sort of legend and myth of Hyperborea, the idea that there was this, thousands of years ago, there was this civilization in the far north, before the far north that became covered by ice. And at some point, this Hyperborea, these Hyperboreans were forced by climate change to leave the far north and disperse to other parts of the world.
Yes.
And was that the whole kind of mystique came to be attached to this Hyperborean civilization. And I discovered that one of the places where the mystique is strongest is Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, the Russians began to think of themselves as the true descendants of the Hyperboreans.
Yes.
And there was, for example, an expedition led by a man called Batchenko back in the 1920s, during the communist period. He went to the area of the Kola Peninsula next to the Arctic Ocean. Then he found all sorts of interesting remains, like pyramids and the remains of paved roads and labyrinths, all kinds of things like that. And he was convinced that he found a sort of remnant of Hyperborea.
Hyperborea, okay.
Stalin came along and all of these things were clamped down upon. But they sort of went underground. After the end of Stalinism, when the thaw came under Khrushchev, they started to come out again. And for example, there were Gurdjieff camps that appeared, and Theosophists and Anthroposophists and Follows of Crowley, and also people who followed the old pre-Christian religion of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And when Gorbachev came and communism fell, there was a huge return to a huge kind of spiritual reawakening.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really what prompted me to write the book, because I found it fascinating how suddenly it was as though a dam had burst. It was as though, well, the Russians are a very spiritual people.
Yes.
Very, very deeply religious people. And though their religiosity had been dammed up during the communist years, and suddenly the dam had broken.
Yeah.
And the spirituality had been treed. And it went in many different directions. But it went in the direction of a revival of the Orthodox Church, which is once again thriving in Russia. Thousands of new churches are being built. Thousands of new priests being consecrated. And but it also there's also a huge revival of paganism. And there's a sort of equivalent of Stonehenge in Russia called Arkaim.
Again, so we have another equivalent of that,
exactly. It's Arkaim. It's a prehistoric site somewhere in the rurals. You're rural. Mm-hmm. And thousands of people go there, for example, at the summer solstice. It's so, sort of like Stonehenge.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all over the country. There are people meeting and celebrating, worshipping the old pagan gods. So this is all very fascinating, and it's not really very much known about in the West. So this is what prompted me to write the book.
It's a highly interesting book, and of course there are days I have also, for example, and another interview that I did on Thoth Hermes was on Mabes, who you also mentioned in your book, who was very strongly influenced by French occultism, of course, by the whole occult revival that started with Eliphas Lévi and then followed up with all kinds of other people, with Papus especially. He influenced a lot, maybe, in St. Petersburg at the time, back the early 1900s. I think maybe then died in a gulag, if I'm not wrong. He was, of course, arrested in 1920, I think.
Yes, I think he did die in a gulag. Yes.
Right, but those books start to reappear now, and that's really a highly interesting approach, a mixture of French tradition with genuine Russian input, I would say.
Yes.
Again, Anthroposophy also had its influence on Thomberg, for example, who was part of that group of Mabes in the early years. So fascinating stories that you related. And it's one of this is maybe a detail for bibliophiles, but it's one of those rare books I know who have a bibliography both in English and in Cyrillic, so in Russian. And I've hardly ever seen that. And I wanted to mention that because it's something that shows how deeply you got involved in the matter. It's great.
Yeah.
Gary Lachman wrote also a book about maybe 2 years before yours appeared on the Return of Holy Russia. Right.
Yes, so I got that.
I think the Russian occultism now 20-30 years after the fall of communism has come back into the center of, well, maybe now we have again another elephant in the room, why we don't speak so much about Russia, which is in the case of occultism, I believe, a pity, because we again lose, maybe don't lose a tradition, but we don't learn enough about the tradition that should be important for us, shouldn't it?
Well, again, I hope my book on Russia will open people's eyes a bit and show them that there's another Russia to the one that they hear about in the media.
Absolutely. How many books have you published, Christopher? How many are there around?
I think it depends what you consider a book, but it's about 20. It's about 20.
What do you consider a book? Tell me.
Well, I've written one or two little travel books and things like that.
Right.
Which maybe don't count, but it's about 20.
Amazing. You mentioned earlier, and I wanted to mention that as well in our talk today, you mentioned your novel, Return of the Tetrad, was translated into Czech, you said.
Yes.
And to be honest, I wasn't aware of it. I only by preparing for our talk today came across it, and I ordered it, and I haven't read a single page of it yet because it only arrived about a week ago and didn't have the time to do that. I have it here in my hand, but he said it was a kind of a youth work of yours. It was republished in 2013, I believe, published publication, I don't know. But tell us about it.
Well, it's a kind of roman à clé, to use the French term.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing it when I was about, I must have been about in my late 20s. And I didn't really have any thought of publication at the time. I think I was just trying to work out certain things in my mind and to record my own kind of development, my own kind of spiritual development. At that time, I knew a man called Gerald York, who had been a disciple of Aleister Crowley. He'd been Crowley's chief disciple back around the 1920s.
Say again the name?
Gerald York. Gerald York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was a remarkable man. He was a brilliant guy. He'd taken a brilliant degree in classics at Cambridge and then went off and became a disciple of Crowley. He was mm-hmm. with Crowley for a number of years and then broke with Crowley because we found it is really impossible to work with Crowley because of his irresponsibility with money. That was one of the reasons.
With money and with people, so sometimes I would say.
Although he remained very friendly with Crowley. Even after he broke with him as a disciple, he remained very friendly. Mm-hmm. And he retained a great respect. He always spoke with great respect about Crowley and affection. But he had another side to him. He was a country squire. He inherited a beautiful, stately home in Gloucestershire, where he used to, lots of people used to visit him, ask him about Crowley and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I visited him there a few times. And there's a sort of a guru character in the novel. There's a narrator who is very loosely based on myself, whom I call Paul Cairns in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, Paul Cairns has been suffering from nightmares, suffering from a particular nightmare. And he goes to this man, Gerald, I call him Gilbert North, who was based on the York character.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to Gilbert North for advice, and Gilbert North finds out that this young man has had a previous incarnation in which he was put through a test and but failed the test. So, well, to cut a long story short, he becomes a kind of disciple to this North man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he's initiated by North into a magical order.
Right.
And the whole series of adventures take place involving a quest for four objects which correspond to the four suits of Greek tarot.
Right.
The four symbols of the four tarot mm-hmm. suits. The cup, the sword, the pentacle, and the... And what's the fourth one? Cup, sword...
The pentacle.
Mm-hmm. And the wand, cup, yes. Sword, pinnacle, and wand.
Wand, yes.
And so there's a whole series of adventures that take place around the quest for these four objects.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote the book over a very long period because I kept returning to it and adding to it.
Okay.
And didn't really have any sort of publication for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Then I offered it to Vladislav Zdoblek in Prague, and he published it in Czech. That was, in fact, the first published edition.
Oh, right. So it was published in Czech before it came out in English.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But then he said he wasn't terribly happy with the ending.
Okay.
And so I thought again about the ending, and I changed the ending so that when it was published in English, it has a different ending from the original Czech version.
Ah, okay. Okay.
But as a piece of literature, it has certain shortcomings, but I did put a lot of heart and soul into it.
Yeah.
So when I read it today, it's I find that in a way I'm quite happy with it. But it's brings up all kinds of memories for it. I read it again.
So it's a discovery of Christopher McIntosh for the reader. Is the quick
in a way,
say that? Well, we are drawing towards the end of our talk, I'm afraid, Christopher. But we should not let you go here before you tell us about your upcoming project. I have seen on Inner Traditions website that Call of the Old Gods is your next publication with I think to be released in February or March or something like that. What will that be about?
Well, it's basically about my path to paganism.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of spiritual autobiography, but it's inevitably something of a general autobiography as well. So,
When a very knowledgeable man writes his autobiographical text, then it'll become always a general text, shouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It starts with my childhood and goes basically right up to the present day.
Exciting. So we're looking forward to that. Any other projects you would like to mention here that are coming maybe after that or any other things that's close to your heart you're working at?
Yes. I'm actually working on a book on fraud.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because as I said, I had a lot of contact with Prague. I've been there many times, and I had a kind of, ever since I read Gustav Meyrink, that was before I went to Prague, I read the novels of Meyrink, and I think I fell in love with Prague through reading those novels.
Yeah. Interesting books and highly recommendable for anyone interested in occultism. And in the European, Central European, German-influenced occultism, I think Meyrink is a focal point of that
tradition.
There
he is. Yes, he's a very key figure.
Absolutely. Well, Christopher, thank you so much for being with us here today. That was a great talk. Do you have any final word you would like to give to our listeners here today?
Well, I think I would just like to repeat that I hope those two books, Occult Germany and Occult Russia, will open people's eyes a bit to what is really valuable in the cultural history of those two countries.
Yeah. And I think beyond that, when somebody understands that, it takes us further how important it is to, especially as an occultist, as a hermeticist, as a Freemason, to keep your mind open to not only see in a society that splits up much more and more into black and white seeing of things, that we should not allow that to happen, and that we always have to see the whole as a unit and a unity. And I think what you did with those two books is extremely powerful and extremely necessary. And thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for those comments.
No, sure. Well, thank you, Christopher. And well, good luck for all your projects. And thanks for being with us here today.
No, you're most welcome.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
Little Bit of Peace, Ein bisschen Frieden, sung by German Eurovision Song Contest competitor and winner in 1982, so 43 years ago, Nicole, and the text is still very much needed. Unfortunately, but fortunately it's there. This was the interview with Christopher McIntosh, and I think we had a lot of fun together, and I hope you had a lot of fun listening to it. I'm sorry that this week's episode was out a week later than initially planned, but I hope nevertheless that you had the patience to wait for it. And because of that, because I was 1 week late in producing this show for just time reasons in my personal life, the next episode 3 of the Pansovers podcast will already be coming to you in a week from now, next week, the next Sunday. Will be episode 3 with my guest Travis Trinka from Australia. Actually, Travis, he recently published with Louis Masonic Books in London a book called The Temple and the Vault. Also a highly interesting book about different Rosicrucian movements and developments. You're gonna hear all about it next week. And so I hope you come back next week to meet us here. If in the meantime you want to know more about the Pansovers, want to know more about what we do, what's happening, go on the website pansovers.com and you'll find not only this podcast, of course, but also the blog, a very highly interesting blog where, by the way, most of those who in those first episodes have been interviewed, so Christopher, Travis Trinka, and also after him, there will be one or two more who are actually also bloggers on that podcast. And so if you're interested in knowing more about it, do go there, pansovers.com. Otherwise, you'll find this podcast, like the Soth Hermes podcast, on all the major podcast outlets where you can subscribe and get immediate news when the coming episode, when next episode is coming out. That was it for this week. Hear you next week, I hope. And for now, I say, take care, stay tuned, hear you soon.